This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The era of white flight may be over. Many big cities that for decades reported dwindling numbers of whites now say that's slowed significantly or even reversed. At the same time, growing numbers of African Americans are leaving those same cities for the suburbs. Last Saturday, a story in the Wall Street Journal described an historic African American church in Washington, D.C. that's now trying to attract whites to survive. A mayoral election in Atlanta expected to feature the first competitive white candidate since the 1980s, and that black flight from San Francisco prompted the creation of the African American Outmigration Task Force. And advisory committee. We'll talk with Mayor Gavin Newsom about that a bit later in the program. The reporter and a demographer will tell us about where this is happening and why, but we also want to know how these changes affect you, about pressures on long-established black businesses and institutions as their customers leave, about new quarrels over culture and class as populations shift. Tell us your story. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, on the opinion page, a recent college grad tells her generation that they'll never be adults as long as they depend on that parental ATM. But first, the end of white flight. Wall Street Journal staff reporter Connor Daugherty joins us from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks.
And you note in your piece, demographic shifts can take years, even decades, to play out, but that if current trends continue, the populations of Atlanta, Georgia, and Washington, D.C. will be less than 50% black within 10 years. That's almost incomprehensible.
Or people living there would say that, but yeah, it's pretty close to 50% right now, so it actually wouldn't even take that much to turn that back, or, you know, to put it below.
And this is causing, as you suggest, you describe them as quarrels. In some cases, they're outright fights.
They sure are.
Describe some for us.
Well, in a bunch of schools, you'll see schools that have had predominantly minority kids in them for however many decades, and suddenly you'll get sort of more professional, wealthier. And typically whiter. I mean, not all white, but a more predominantly white group will come in. And I talked to a number of schools about this. One was in the story, but a lot of times it sort of sounds funny and cliche or whatever. But you'll have parents where they have a sort of like a more, I don't know, for lack of a better term, touchy-feely approach to education, and they think drilling is bad and this sort of thing. And, it ends up beyond just, different races. I mean, it ends up being with a more professional
Class struggle, too.
Yeah, and sort of a philosophy and all that. Yeah.
Now, the school you describe in Brooklyn, the argument developed over the long tradition there of an ice cream social to raise funds, and the new parents weren't so thrilled about that.
Yeah, a number of the new parents told me that they had a fight, and they were saying they didn't want their kids eating sort of sugary, fatty foods. And then the other parents were like, I don't know, I guess ice cream, right? It's right up there with kittens and, it can't be
pie,
bad,
yeah,
right? Yeah.
Right. And this developed to the point where, dozens of students ended up leaving the school.
About 20.
It's not quite dozens, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. No, no. You can hear me going back and forth with the education department, right? And basically they ended up leaving. I think that I talked to a lot of other schools that were harder to get into the story, but they, where things kind of turned out bad. This happened to be a particularly bad case where the parents just really didn't feel like, on both sides, that they could. One didn't want to change because they had a school tradition that they wanted to continue with, and not just over ice cream, but over a lot of things. And the others didn't want to be in a school where they didn't have more control over how they could set the curriculum and that sort of thing.
So. Another place you described was in San Francisco in the Fillmore District, traditionally an African-American district where so many blacks have left town that the restaurants and the bookstores that they used to support are now struggling.
Yeah, I spoke to Marcus Books, a a bookstore named after Marcus Garvey, and their motto is books by and about black people everywhere. And the 88-year-old owner told me she's actually losing money, but her husband wanted to open that store, and she feels it's sort of a labor of love to keep it open. Now, they have another great store in Oakland, and that one, I think, does quite well, and they essentially subsidize one with the other. But.
And this is a story. The American population never stays still, yet when people have lived in the same kinds of neighborhoods for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, it feels like forever. It feels like it's theirs. And then all of a sudden, things seem to be changing all around them, the ground being pulled out literally underneath their feet.
Yeah, I mean, that's how a lot of people feel. It's a tough thing, too, because you end up with a lot of sort of, you know, interwoven conflicts. For instance, you know, tons of minority families of all, you know, whatever race or ethnicity they have houses that they bought a long time ago, many of them, and they sell them for great prices. So, you know, if someone comes up to you, to your house you bought, you know, in San Francisco in, you know, 1978 for $65,000 or something like that, and they want to give you $1.5 million for it, you know, a lot of people jump at that. So,
sure, yeah.
I mean, but then their neighbor who maybe didn't get lucky enough, I'm obviously making this up, but, you know, like they might have high rent, you know, and so you see these conflicts playing out all the time where, you know, people feel bad about, you know, on the one hand, one side of it is really angry and the other side is really happy. So even within the community, you'll see a ton of, you know, fight.
Yeah, contradictions. Anyway, let's get some callers in on the conversation. We're talking with Connor Daugherty of the Wall Street Journal about his story that was published on Saturday, The End of White Flight. We're describing some of the conflicts and tensions that has engendered as populations shift. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Gloria joins us on the line. Gloria calling from Sacramento in California.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
I enjoy your show.
Thanks.
But my comment is, that isn't gentrification basically designed to do that, to push the poorer families out of the community, to make way for the families who can, you know, can afford it and, you know, who have a higher income?
No, I'm not. Is it designed or is that the effect of gentrification, Connor Daugherty?
I'm asking, isn't that what it's all about?
Well, that depends on who you ask, right? But I would say that you would never find a it would be difficult for you to find a politician who would tell you they designed it that way, but that is often ultimately what happens. Yeah, you're certainly correct about that. But, you know,
you describe in the story empty nesters and young professionals being attracted to the city for any number of reasons. Gas prices. No,
yeah, well, and not only that, a lot of them are, you know, beyond that, a lot of them are staying longer. You know, I mean, there's a certain amount of young professionals that will move into a city no matter what. They've done it forever. But they leave when they have kids, right? And some of them are staying a little longer now.
I just think people who have the means go where the things are most convenient, and the shift is coming back to the city. And that was my comment.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call,
Thank
Gloria.
You.
She's also pointing out, I think, that certainly the black middle class is leaving these cities for, well, the same reason the whites left the cities after the end of the Second World War, for a house and a lawn and a good school.
No, that's totally true. One of the things I thought was really interesting with this story, or just seeing what's going on, is that even though there is gentrification and all these things that are you know, create a lot of conflicts, but there's a lot of affordable housing going into a lot of these places. Now, nowhere near as much as some people would like, and certainly the neighborhoods end up pushing out a lot of people. But, you know, if you look at some of these neighborhoods, I mean, it almost seems like there's sort of a kind of a new chapter in the city brewing. I mean, you will see I met a ton of people in Shaw where, you know,
it's a neighborhood here in Washington.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Where, you know, you'll have like a guy who lives in a, you know, a group of people who live in a, you know, $700,000 condo or something. And then there's an affordable housing thing across the alley from them. And that person pays, you know, $600 a month or whatever. And there is actually a group, I forget what name it was because I didn't end up putting them in the story, but and there was two of these people, and they were neighbors, and they actually knew each other's situation, that were on some sort of neighborhood betterment, you know, for lack of a better term. So my point is that it seems that this is being done in a different way than the suburbs. Again, maybe not as sort of equitably as people would like, but it definitely seems like this movement is a different, you know, there's more consideration this time around.
Well, joining us now from his office here in Washington, D.C. is William Fry, a demographer at the Brookings Institution, and nice to have you on the program as well.
Good to be with you, Conan.
And give us some idea of the, this seems highly significant. I mean, the white flight, whites leaving the cities, of course, blacks were leaving the cities too, but nowhere near as quickly. Since the end of the Second World, this has been, it seems almost written in stone.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think it's really something that's counterintuitive to a lot of people that, you know, white flight is over. I'm not sure that we can say it that definitively. But when you look at the numbers from the census estimates, sure, the cities that stand out are these highly gentrified cities like San Francisco and Washington, D.C., Boston, and so forth. But if you look at the list of all of the cities over 300,000, even though those eight or nine stand out that are featured in the story, there has been a sort of, I would say, bump down in the level of white-out migration. In other words, when you look at the percentage of the city that's white, it used to go gradually down all the way from 1950, perhaps through 1990, even through 2000. But when you look at 2000 to 2006, practically all of these cities have a drastically lower level of decline in white percentage, and even all of these, some of them have had a bumped up in white percentage due to some white return or to minority movement to the suburbs, as we've been discussing.
And can this be categorized? This is something obviously highly local, and we just have a few seconds left before we get a break, but this seems to be historic.
Well, yeah, I mean, you could say, you know, it really is the end of a trend when you look at the numbers in detail. Now, that's not to say what might happen next decade, but right now it looks like that era is in the past.
We're talking about what may be the end of white flight and tensions now playing out in a lot of big cities. In a few minutes, Gavin Newsom, the mayor of San Francisco, will join us to tell us what his city is doing in response to those changing demographics. Give us a call and tell us what's happening where you live. Are there new tensions, new quarrels as populations shift? Are old institutions being challenged to find, well, congregants or customers? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also check out our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, where if trends continue, the proportion of African Americans in this city will fall below 50% in the next few years. For the first time in roughly half a century, based on data from the census, the era of white flight from U.S. cities may be over. We're talking about how these changes affect you, about pressures on long-established businesses and institutions as customers leave, about new quarrels over culture and class as populations change. Tell us your story. Our number, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. There you can also find a link to the article, The End of White Flight, which Connor Daugherty reported in this Saturday's editions of The Wall Street Journal. He's among our guests. Also with us, William Fry, a demographer at the Brookings Institution, and San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom will join us in a few minutes. In the meantime, let's get another caller on the line. This is Charlotte. Charlotte calling us from San Francisco.
Oh, hi. Yes. I just wanted to make a short comment. My first response to this subject matter was, hold on one second, I got a shift, is that I would think it would be a very good sign that the blacks were leaving the city, because it would mean they were did not need to live in a neighborhood that was for protection. They didn't have to band together, and that they could afford to leave and just become more integrated. So that's my comment.
It's an interesting thought. And Connor Daugherty, as you pointed out in the piece, I think all those things that Charlotte is describing are true. Nevertheless, the people who are left behind in San Francisco, you described as not just poor, but very poor.
Yeah, that's what I got all that data from the city. I mean, obviously it comes from the census as well. But the number of social problems that have sort of disproportionately hit the African American community are even like worse now. You know, it's.
I would only point out here that the social problem has been the segregation of the black people, and I think that's being missed. So I'm going to get off the air. Thank you very much.
All right. Drive carefully, Charlotte.
All right. I will. Thanks.
I just meant, and I'm sure you'll hear Mayor Newsom speak about this because we talked about it in Hunter's Point together, but, you know, pick your stat, obesity, cancer rate, anything. It falls harder on that population in San Francisco. And I think one of the reasons for that is that, you know, a huge amount of the African American middle class has left and they live in the suburbs now. Mm. And so it's basically people who can afford to, the people who can't really afford to leave. It's a lot of public housing. It's a lot of that. I mean, of course, you get a ton of young professionals who are African American, but they're basically interlopers. You know what I mean? They are sort of to San Francisco as I am to New York. I'm actually from San Francisco.
William Fry, I wanted to ask you about this. This part of it, it's been gradual. Demographics, it doesn't startle you. It's just every once in a while you hit a tipping point.
Yes, I think that's right. Certainly the white flight has been sort of hunkering down for quite a few years now, and the black suburbanization has actually been in our radar for at least a decade or so. But what happens is once we get to a certain stage, many cities are trying to find a niche for that middle-class population to draw them back. Some of them are empty nester whites or retiree whites or just middle-class empty nesters. They wouldn't necessarily need to be white, but a lot of them are. And, of course, young people. And so that's what's starting to reverse the trend with respect to the white population. And as we see in a lot of these very gentrified places, it makes a big difference.
And we've been describing situations in cities when that population changes. What's happening in the suburbs? Are these new developments or are the same kinds of challenges and quarrels breaking out there, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's also the case. I mean, we do have more African Americans moving to the suburbs. Many of them are going to more segregated suburbs rather than to more integrated suburbs, which is a whole ton of literature has shown that there's a preference on the part of many suburban mover blacks to live in a community with other African Americans. But it also means that there are these cultural issues that tend to sort of show up again in the suburbs.
Let's talk with Candace. Candace on the line with us from Wichita in Kansas.
I had kind of a question and a comment. I live in Wichita, Kansas. It's one of the smaller on the end of the American cities over 300,000. And I've noticed that we've had more of an influx of whites into our downtown area, particularly because the city has followed this American model, the new American model for metropolitan, which is let's eliminate all the low-income housing downtown and, move it out of the city to try to make our city look more wealthy, for instance, with, high-end lofts, more expensive housing. So that's kind of the experience we've had here. I don't know if that resonates across the country.
Connor Daugherty, you describe in your story a lot of cities that are going through creation improvements like parks and indeed exchanging, in some cases, public housing for much more expensive housing for people to move into.
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening. It's happening all over the place. If you think about it, somewhere around I guess Bill could probably tell you exactly the date, but somewhere around the 70s and 80s, cities lost all their industry. And so they were sort of left with these, it's a lot of fun to live in a city now. All the bad things that were there about cities in the 50s or 60s, industry, bad air, truck traffic, trains, whatever, it's all gone. So it's like, they're very nice places to live, and cities have gone in, taken those factories and other other buildings and turned them into retail, residential. I mean, obviously that's a trend that's been going on for a long time, but it seems that that's brought some whites back. And in the meantime, a ton of the minorities have left. Now those two things sort of seem to be opposing. You have higher property values, which either pushes people out or they sell, and then it brings some wealthier people in, and it just so happens that the wealthier people tend to be a higher proportion white.
Candace, thanks for the call. Let's see if we go now to Bridget. Bridget with us. Bridget's calling from Macomb in Michigan.
Yes, I have a couple comments. I am in Macomb, Michigan, which is a suburb of Detroit. And Detroit had a great white flight from the riots. and unfortunately still seems to be very racially segregated. And as you were just saying, they've been trying very hard to develop communities, businesses in downtown, and they don't seem to be doing very well. Of course, we have the automobile industry, which is floundering. Where we are in Macomb Township, our school district is probably gone. I've lived here for 5 years. The schools have probably gone from about 98% Caucasian population to about 85% Caucasian in just 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the people moving in have been African Americans, which is great, and a lot of Indian population moving in. Detroit also has a very high Arab population, as you probably know. And I'm wondering if your guest talks about other ethnicities and the quick demographic changes that have happened in American cities, as we've had a lot of different ethnicities, whether it be Asian, Indian, or a lot of the people that are in the Detroit area,
mm-hmm.
Well, along with Muslim populations.
And William Fry, I'll ask you to address that and throw Latinos into the mix as well.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I think this is an element that's been missing from our discussion up till now, because we've been focusing largely on whites and blacks, and most certainly as we have new immigrant minorities coming to the U.S. They first came to what you might call big immigrant magnet cities, Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, Miami, and so forth. But now they're spreading out all over the country, and particularly leaving the cities to go to the suburbs, or initially going right to the suburbs when they come to a metropolitan area. And part of the part of the reason we have an increase in the percentage white in a lot of the gateway cities is because those Hispanics who might have first gone to the city 10 years ago are now going to the suburbs, and it makes the city become whiter in a way because of that. Now, in the suburban areas of you might call the industrial part of the country, Detroit, Cleveland, places like that, we are getting a bigger mix of race and ethnic groups, and these are generally slow-growing areas, slow-growing metros, slow-growing cities. So it does cause some challenges in keeping up with these new populations that are trying to integrate into the areas. But I think it's good because it brings population growth to places that otherwise would not be growing nearly as rapidly.
May I ask one more question?
Go ahead, please.
What is the actual demographic growth in the cities now that you were mentioning that? Are cities actually growing in population?
Or
some
are, some
aren't. Changing in the percentage of demographics?
You know, most large cities in the United States are growing. You know, two-thirds of them are growing, but a significant number of them are losing whites but gaining other minorities. This group that we're talking about, these cities which are getting a little bit whiter, are kind of a mini-trend that we just started a sort of look at as a new phenomenon, but it seems to be another way that cities can grow in different parts of the country.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
And Bridget, thanks for making it. Appreciate it. And William Fry, thank you for your time today.
Sure.
William Fry, a demographer for the Brookings Institution, joined us from his office in Washington, D.C. With us now from his office in San Francisco is Mayor Gavin Newsom. And Mayor Newsom, nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
And tell me, we've been describing the changes of demographics in San Francisco, particularly the departure of large numbers of African Americans. What kind of a challenge does that represent for a city like San Francisco?
Well, I think the greatness of our city is defined in our composite, remarkable ability for people to live together and advance together across every conceivable difference, regardless of race, religion, ethnicity, and sexual orientation, rich or poor. I mean, that's what makes cities so vibrant and so fundamental to the life of our states and this extraordinary place we call home, our country. And so at its core, a city loses part of its soul when it loses part of its heritage and history. And particularly in the case of San Francisco, we've seen the largest decline since 1970 of African Americans of any big city in America, and it's something we care deeply about and something we want to turn around.
The story that we're talking about that was written by Connor Daugherty in the Wall Street Journal on Saturday describes the Fillmore Jazz Preservation District in the Fillmore District there in San Francisco, yet also an area where businesses that defined an era are now gone or dying.
Yeah, I mean, we were the Harlem of the West Coast of the United States. When back in its heyday, the Fillmore in San Francisco was one of the most vibrant communities anywhere in this country. It was predominantly African American, and so much of the jazz heritage came from that community. We've spent the last 5 years trying to reconcile and right the wrongs of the past and the horrendous realities of redevelopment and urban renewal in the 60s and 70s. And in that context, we've tried to revitalize that Jazz Fillmore district and brought in some predominantly African-American businesses and brought back some remarkable jazz clubs. But at the end of the day, for some, it just seems to ring hollow. It's too symbolic. It's not substantive enough. And as a consequence of that, we've tried to reach down deeper and to understand the context of what's pulling the population away and how we can push to keep people here and retain the numbers of people that we currently have and recruit and make a case for San Francisco's future being a future for all people, regardless of race. And so in that context, we are looking at the fundamental issues of affordability and education and healthcare and the issues of disparities, environmental disparities and income disparities, and trying to get to these root issues in a way that can distinguish the city and distinguish our efforts.
We're talking with Mayor Gavin Newsom of San Francisco, also with us Connor Daugherty, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, who wrote The End of White Flight, the piece we're writing about in Saturday's editions of the newspaper. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Mayor Newsom, a caller earlier suggested the idea that, well, to some degree, if African Americans can get wealthy enough to move out of the city to a nice suburb outside, well, it may not be good for San Francisco, but might be good for them.
Yeah, no, and I mean, we don't begrudge anyone leaving our city. We're a very transient city, that is true, but we're also a city that is growing. And to William's point, we're one of those two-thirds of American cities that are growing quite substantially. We just challenged our Census Bureau data, suggesting we have 100,000 more people than the Census Bureau announced recently. And we're seeing huge numbers of newcomers into our city, but we're not seeing those numbers increase for African Americans. And again, I want a city that is representative of the state. I want a city that's representative of this country. And I think it's important to reconcile that and to look at the underlying causes. I mean, 4 out of 5 toxic waste dumps in America are in predominantly African American communities. We have concentrations of poverty in cities like San Francisco that are disgraceful. And so we've got to start to address those fundamentals by rebuilding public housing, rebuilding communities and people's lives, and deal with asset creation, not just income, and begin to focus on environmental injustice. And one of the areas that you'll be hearing a lot about, and you're hearing a lot about it now, but I think it's going to ratchet up, is the extraordinary opportunities that we have in front of us to lock those that have been locked out of the industrial economy and make sure they're locked into this new green economy, workforce training jobs, and creating the jobs of the future with these alternative fuel technologies. And I think you're hearing a lot of cities that are addressing economic development and the issues of social inequality and environmental injustice in ways that also address the larger issue of climate change as also a key strategy to begin to turn the tide.
Well, let's see if we get another caller in on this conversation. Diane, Diane's with us from St. Paul in Minnesota.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, I just wanted to say that I see the exact same trend happening in St. Paul, Minnesota. I live in the Dayton Bluff area, St. Paul. I'm across the Mississippi River from the downtown area of St. Paul. This weekend I went to the farmer's market in downtown St. Paul, and we have a lot of Hmong and Caucasian vendors, and the buyers are mostly Caucasian.
And that's a change?
From what I've seen, yes, definitely. A lot of upper-scale condos going in. Like I said, the business, the revitalization of downtown St. Paul, a lot of white faces.
Hmm. And I guess Mayor Newsom, she's describing change, which on one face of it is very positive, and I'm sure the same thing happens in San Francisco. Property values there are among the highest in the nation,
yeah,
among the highest in the world. The fact of the matter is that does not come without a price.
Yeah, Neil, that's the great challenge, and it really is a challenge, and there's no soundbite on this, but it's the whole fundamental of gentrification. You make a substantial investment in a community, and as a consequence of that investment that people seem to enjoy, people are priced out or take advantage of the increased prices. And as you said just a moment ago, people then sell their home for a profit and then take the opportunity to move to the suburbs or the exurbs and buy a larger home. And so it is very, very complex. It is creating opportunities and making investments at the same time, maintaining the status of those that don't want to move or feel that they're being pushed out. And, you know, that's why we are fundamentally in San Francisco, we try to address these things in multiple fashions. With the highest minimum wage outside of Santa Fe, New Mexico, in America. We have universal preschool in our city, targeted disproportionately African American and Latino community. We're doing universal health care. I mean, this is one of the great stories of any American city. Over a third of our population has now got universal health access that was previously locked out just a year ago.
And Mayor Newsom, I don't mean to cut you off, but we're
help advance this effort substantially.
Thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Connor Daugherty, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal, who wrote the article we based this program on. Thanks for the piece. Nice job.
Thank you.
He joined us from our bureau in New York. Up next, 20-somethings getting by in the big city. When is it time to cut the purse strings from mom and dad? Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.